Brian Pearson, team leader for Indian Nations Law Team at Godfrey & Kahn, wrote an article about the Supreme Court's recent decision on Michigan versus Bay Mills Indian Community for the National Law Review. In the article, Pearson noted that the Supreme Court's ruling may have a significant impact on tribal sovereignty. I'm Susan Shannon, and this is Indian Times. The case of Michigan versus Bay Mills Indian Community involved commercial land purchased by the tribe for casino use. The argument was that this land did not qualify as, quote, Indian land. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of Bay Mills Indian Community, but as Brian Pearson points out, the ruling was further complicated by an earlier decision.
The case focused on whether the court should modify the doctrine of tribal sovereign immunity as the court had previously articulated it in 1998 in the decision of the Kiowa manufacturing decision.
Kiowa Tribe versus Manufacturing Technologies is the 1998 case to which Pearson is referring. It involved a $285,000 stock agreement with Manufacturing Technologies. The tribe defaulted on the stock payment and Manufacturing Technologies sued in state court. That state court decision, which ruled in favor of the plaintiff, led to a succession of appeals with similar outcomes, that is, until it reached the Supreme Court in 1998. The Supreme Court's ruling, as delivered by Justice Kennedy, maintained that Indian nations were entitled to immunity from contract lawsuits, whether on or off Indian lands. In Michigan versus Bay Mills, the Supreme Court basically upheld its previous decision by ruling in favor of Bay Mills Indian Community. But Pearson suggests the doctrine of tribal sovereign immunity has been diminished nonetheless.
Here's the thing about the decision. It's dodging a bullet, as many people have characterized it, but it has left the doctrine weaker. And the reason I say that is because just a couple of sort of obvious distinctions. When the Supreme Court last visited the doctrine in 1998, it was a 6-3 decision, and it generated a majority opinion of about 2,500 words and a dissent of about 2,000 words. Well, 16 years later, it's a 5-4 decision, and it generated majority opinions of over 10,000 words and dissenting opinions of over 7,000 words. The attack on the doctrine by the dissent is much more vigorous and includes circumstances that, according to the dissent, have emerged in the last 16 years to reveal the incorrectness of the decisions. The dissent dwells on the fact that the tribes are competing in interstate commerce to a much higher degree than they were then, and it complains about what it calls the tribes' exploitation of immunity to pay taxes for which they're legally liable, and they're taking advantage of in the tobacco industry, or even the payday lending industry, which has become very controversial, that they've used their tribal sovereign immunity to avoid state laws that apply, but that simply cannot be enforced against them because of tribal sovereign immunity.
Pearson said that states can now go to Congress armed with the arguments culled from the dissenting opinion.
They'll say, well, look at this. Here's the Supreme Court. They've blessed tribal sovereign immunity by a very close 5-4 vote. Even the majority is not that enthusiastic, and look at this dissent, which is cataloging all of the injustices. Congress, you ought to do something about it. The Supreme Court is inviting you to do something about it. So that's one consequence of the weakened state of tribal sovereign immunity, in my view.
Pearson said the court also identified areas of tribal sovereign immunity that are problematic, such as how does one go about getting restitution from a tribal entity or its representatives, and is there special justification for abandoning that sovereign immunity? By the court pointing out that's not what's up for discussion here, they bring attention to it, and how to get around it.
Well, that's a very obvious invitation to a litigant in a case to argue to a lower court, we are a plaintiff that hasn't chosen to deal with the tribe, and we have no alternative way of getting relief for this conduct, and therefore you should give us a there's a special justification for limiting tribal sovereign immunity in this instance. And the lower courts, who often express their dissatisfaction with tribal sovereign immunity, are likely to view that footnote in the Supreme Court's decision as an invitation to do precisely that.
As more and more tribal economies co-mingle with commercial interests and state governments, the issue of tribal sovereignty is sure to face additional scrutiny and challenges.